This is the podcast for Monday, February 14th, Valentine's Day, 2011. Theories of Knowledge. A couple of brief announcements. First, Students for Liberty is having their first meeting in a long time in the student student government room, building 1, room 260. Free pizza. They'll be right after class. Actually, I think they have it slated for 4 p.m. So a little break in between. If you want to meander over there early and just hang out, that's fine too. They got cushy chairs there. The pizza will probably be there early and warmed up. So I'll pass this around. This is going to be an organizational meeting. I'm meeting to share ideas, decide the future direction of the club. So if you are interested in anything related to the Constitution, liberty, conservative or libertarian political values, individual freedom, personal responsibility, come on down. And it's going to be a student club. I'm just the faculty advisor. I'll be hanging out there. I won't be running the club. Ryan Wilson is the acting president this term. So see where it goes. See if there's any. There seems to be a sea change in politics in the national scene. I noticed that and in Liberty News, Ron Paul won the CPAC straw poll again. So CPAC is this big. It's the Conservative Political Action Committee. It's this big conservative convention. And in recent years, it's been overrun by young people like yourselves, and young people tend to love Ron Paul. He's a kind of libertarian Republican. He's a Republican because it allows him to be part of the major party and actually get elected, unlike libertarian candidates who, if they're lucky if they get elected mayor, usually it's, you know, county commissioner, sanitation district 3, dog catcher, you know, those are the types of offices that libertarian party members aspire to. So he actually Ron Paul ran for president on the libertarian ticket in 1988, figured he wasn't getting any place as a libertarian, so he switched over to the GOP and managed to get a district in Texas and has been there for quite a while. Anywho, on to theories of knowledge. And we'll be doing a bit about political knowledge in the last week. So if you're interested in politics and the news and how do you know what's biased and what isn't biased, what's accurate, what's inaccurate, where to get good sources of news from, particularly in trying to decide your political philosophy, that's what we'll be talking about in epistemological issues surrounding Valentine's Day. None come to mind. Oh, what is love? If love can't be verified empirically or analytically, does that mean love doesn't exist? This is sort of, in talking last time, we were talking about analytic versus continental philosophy. And as you trace analytic and continental philosophy, continental philosophy sort of branches into existentialism, and it's sort of expansive and not, I would say, it turns into something which isn't terribly rigorous and tends to be both heavily conceptual and also not terribly, I'd use the word systematic, but existentialism in a lot of respects is a more kind of romantic philosophy. It wants to express itself, but it's not overly concerned with logical consistency and with, I suppose, it's not overly concerned with, I'll say, logical consistency and being, you know, you might say, rational or scientific. As a matter of fact, a lot of the later, you know, continental strains, they have a sort of an anti-rationalist bent. And the whole Romantic movement in the 19th century was kind of a movement against the age of reason. So the Romantic era said, you know, it was a reaction against the Industrial Revolution, against the Scientific Revolution. It was an idea of getting back to nature and not being so damn logical. And so existentialism emerged within that context and is a more kind of expressive philosophy. And I think you'll see that particularly with Kierkegaard, who's widely regarded as the first existentialist. writing in the 19th century, and he has a lot of those sort of views that reason isn't enough, that you can't live your life in a purely rational way, that there's a role for subjectivity, there's a role for emotion, and there's a role for spirituality. So I suppose if you follow analytic philosophy, on the other hand, you know, down its path, starting out with Hume, you get this movement in later analytic philosophy called logical positivism. Philosophy. Even though Søren Kierkegaard is actually a Dane, he's within that at the continental movement. And then with Hume, you have logical positive or. What's known as analytic philosophy. And then the sort of extreme version, logical positivism. Which includes typically some form of what's known as verificationism, which is that something isn't really true unless it can be verified. And the idea that the way you verify things is through the scientific method. And if something isn't, as Hume says, a truth of reason, or it's not a something known through the senses, then logical positivism says it's just nonsense. It has no propositional content. So in an extreme version, you know, a statement like "my mother loves me," you know, it isn't strictly speaking something you can really know because it's not really a truth. This is why you get a kind of reaction against this, and there's this tension between these two extreme views, analytic and continental philosophy. And again, that's not all analytic philosophy. That's like a really narrow kind of extreme version. You know, in continental philosophy, you get the really extreme version in somebody like Derrida or post-structuralism, where nothing is true, or what's true is a matter of, you know, who's in charge of the political system, which is the sort of the post-structuralist idea that it's a sort of neo-Marxist interpretation of truth, where truth is defined by the victors of class struggle. But there is no sort of external truth out there in reality. There's only subjective truth, and what's true depends on who's able to foist their views about what's true on the masses via, you know, propaganda or guns or whatever. Let's talk about the ethics of belief. W.K. Clifford has a very strong and one might even say moralistic belief about your obligations. And actually, before we get to the ethics of belief, just one other quick announcement. You have till Wednesday, 7 o'clock, to take the second midterm exam. If you were dissatisfied with your first score, I recommend focusing on key terms. Focusing on the views of various philosophers, make sure that they are not bleeding one into another in your mind, that you have a distinct and clear impression of here's what Berkeley believed, here's what Hume believed, here's what Kant believed, and then that you know these key concepts like impressions and ideas in Hume, or in Berkeley, that you understand what he thinks about Locke's primary and secondary distinction, or in Kant that you know what the difference between noumena and phenomena is, and so all these are what Kant's categories are, which we didn't talk about much in class but are covered in the text. So all those things, and then the particular arguments like Berkeley's infinite regress argument about substance supporting qualities, you know, all this, you know, the test will be based on the main things we talk about in class here. It's not going to be based on trivia or kind of side points. It'll be things that we focus in on class and things that are highlighted in the meeting. So another thing you want to do, if you might want to do, if you want to go the extra mile, stop by office hours. I have office hours today after class, 3:30 to 4:30. Tomorrow, I think there's 3 to 4. I'm also available by appointment. And if seeing me means you got to take the exam a day or two late, you know, that's I'm open to that too. I don't like to have a lot of people taking the exam late, but if the only time you can see me is, you know, Wednesday at 1, and that means you won't be able, your next chance you'll be able to take the exam, you won't be able to take it till Thursday, then that's, you know, fine with me. So, but you need to see me about any exception for the deadline. But I want to accommodate you to make sure that you're just not sort of rushed into taking the exam and don't have enough time to see me and you really need help and you take the exam because you got to take it by 7 and then you end up blowing it. So the other thing I'd recommend, if you fancy yourself a rugged individualist and you thought, oh, well, I don't need a 3x5 card, the difficulty of the test is based on the idea that you have a 3x5 card that you can write down things you can't remember on. So that's so keep that in mind. Also, in producing a 3x5 card, it will cement into your mind concepts and ideas which you otherwise wouldn't get, because it forces you to distill down what you think is absolutely necessary for the exam in a small space. And in doing so, it will help you learn. So it's one of the purposes for the 3x5 card, not as a crutch, although I suppose it's in part is there to alleviate test anxiety. But the primary purpose is that in making 3x5 card, you'll actually do some more study for the exam because I've given you an additional motivation to do it. Okay, now on to the ethics of belief. So W.K. Clifford, with gusto, pushes this idea that there are ethical dimensions of your beliefs. And people tend not to think about what they believe as being a moral thing, although certain things, I suppose, you might think there's an ethics of belief in the sense that, think about, like, what would be an example of an immoral belief? Yeah, there you go. It's okay to molest little children, right? You might say, well, that's not sort of my thing, but I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I mean, most people would think that's a morally reprehensible idea. Or, you know, some people might add, well, it might be another one. What about, like, the people of particular races are inferior? You might say, well, you know, I just believe in the supremacy of the white race. You know, I think that other people ought to be treated with equal dignity and respect, but, you know, it's a scientific fact that they're inferior. And most people would say that in order to believe that, there's got to be something wrong with you. That shows you have a problem with your character, that you would believe something like that. And there's, like, some sort of interesting issues here. Think about, like, the conscientious Nazi. You know, is there... He really thinks that it's, you know, the Jews need to be exterminated, and that the fatherland is the highest value, and that what's good for Germany is good for the world. Or take the suicide bomber, who really believes that it's his religious duty to blow up a bunch of innocent Jewish children at a birthday party, or a bunch of teenagers at a pizza parlor, or some people just trying to get to work on a bus. Right, so he thinks in his mind that's the right thing to do. So these are some issues that will, you know, come into a little later. And I think that these, well, I think we'll have some answers to these issues when we look at Clifford. But Clifford starts out thinking in general of what are your duties when you're deciding what you believe. And again, assuming you can decide what you believe, and actually we're going to come to that near the end of the chapter, whether you really have control over your beliefs, and if so, what sort of control. So he starts out with this example of the ship owner. So what's his purpose of bringing up this example of the ship owner? And maybe if I could get somebody who hasn't spoken up or hasn't spoken up in some time, to sort of, this is a kind of a fairly, I think, easy question based on the reading, if you've read at least the first few pages or skimmed it or looked at the question in the back. So what's the ship owner example all about? Maybe from not only the usual suspects, I'm going to sort of broaden our conversation here. Yes, sir?
I'll take a stab at it.
All right.
I'm not sure. So is it like if I am a ship owner and somebody wants to like rent my ship or whatever from me, mm-hmm. and I know that my ship's kind of rickety and it's not super well built, and there's a chance that it could just kind of break in half as soon as they get into it,
yeah.
and I let them sail across whatever ocean my ship is, that is it my responsibility if they, you know, if they die?
That's the issue sets out. Right? So you're the ship owner, you got the ship, and it's getting kind of old, and maybe you should have it inspected, but hey, you know, you have faith that the ship can make it to the next point, and you kind of suppress your doubts that, well, maybe there might be something wrong with it, and then you send it off, and you boom, voyage, and all the people get out. These are immigrants. They're leaving your country for a hope for a better life in another country. And there's a bunch of cargo that you're on board as well. And the ship sinks to the bottom of the ocean. You collect the insurance money, but the people who drown and all the cargo that's lost, you know, is a result of your poorly thought out, poorly justified belief. And so what's Clifford's point about this?
We should be responsible for the thoughts or what the thought is involved with the process, you know, maintenance. If he has that doubt in his mind, is he responsible, or is it just it happened and how we think about that? You know, if he had no doubts about it at all, would he still feel the same, or still feel responsible? Or
yeah, this guy probably cursed his bad luck, you know. Oh, shoot. Yeah. It must have been fate. Oh, well, you know, these things happen. You know, it's a tragic loss for all those concerned. Meanwhile, he collects the insurance money, and he's no worse for wear, whereas his passengers weren't able to escape the consequences of his bad thinking. And I think you can sum up this. There's a statement near the end. If you want to identify his thesis on page 164, and you know, you take these English classes and they say, you know, sometimes you have to dig deep to find the thesis. One of the things I appreciate, like you read, you know, Hegel, Reason and History. What is Hegel's thesis? Who knows? W.K. Clifford, a shorter work, to be sure. Clifford tells you to sum up. What does that mean? Here's a summary of everything I've said so far. Here's my thesis. It is wrong always, everywhere. This is page 164, by the way. To sum up, it is wrong always, everywhere, for anyone to believe anything upon insufficient evidence. That's Clifford's view. And so what did the ship owner do? He believed something on insufficient evidence. He didn't have evidence that his ship would get to its destination. And because he made his decision to send the ship out based on insufficient evidence, therefore, it led to bad consequences. So, it's wrong. You could paraphrase this as it's wrong. It's wrong to have unjustified beliefs. And he says that it's wrong for two reasons. One is it leads to bad consequences. And this is typically for others. There's some quote by Larry Mercury, which I should have looked up for a class. I can't quite remember it now. He said that the fool is usually not the one who pays for his foolishness. In other words, I don't know if you've had this experience, but often the incompetence of others is something that the incompetent themselves have paid for, but you end up paying for. So you get people who act foolishly, and often they get off scot-free. Like the example of the ship owner. The ship owner was insured. He got all his money back. And all those people died, and people said, well, this is unfortunate that this happened. But that's sort of the breaks, and, you know, ships sink, and what can you do? Whereas all his passengers, you know, died drowned to death. and didn't get to their new life, and all their opportunities were dashed to bits and sank to the bottom. So, the bad consequences, and you might put, I suppose, maybe I'll put both these here. I mean, I don't want to state this too strongly, and I'm not sure if Clifford necessarily thinks this, but he thinks both for oneself and others. What if the ship had made its voyage? What if the ship had arrived safely at its destination?
Still wrong.
Still wrong. So why is it still wrong? Nothing bad happened.
It could have.
It could have, right. But so,
morality is not based on consequences.
Yeah, it's wrong. Wrong in itself. And then I suppose one way of putting it is it's kind of dangerous. You can still think about it in terms of consequences, in that even though it didn't lead to bad consequences, it's the sort of thing that does. Imagine you're at a party and you're having a good time, and you know you're slamming down those rum and cokes one after the other, and then you have a Long Island iced tea. And, you know, you maybe have, like, a couple of daiquiris, because it's, like, and all the sweet stuff, and you're like, hey, you know, I'm feeling good. And maybe you're down a couple of Red Bulls, and because you're kind of feeling kind of sluggish. And then you pick your car keys out of your pocket and stagger out the parking lot and drive home. And as you weave back and forth across the highway and going over to the wrong side of the road, You don't run into any of the cars because it's late at night. You blow through some stoplights, and you're driving the wrong way on the freeway for a little bit. And finally, you manage to find your way home, and you park your car in the front lawn, and that's it. And so even though you might have to, do a little lawn work later on, you know the worst of the wear. Was there anything wrong with what you did? Yeah, that was a horrible thing to do, right? Why? Because you could have killed somebody. You could have killed yourself. You could have killed somebody else that's trying to get home from his crappy job at the mini mart, or maybe he has a job at a bar serving drunks like yourself. And two, 3 o'clock in the morning, driving home, you're taking your life in your hands. I always try to stay off the road at this time. It's a dangerous time to be out because there are all these drunks weaving around, right? So even though he didn't hit anybody, he could have. And that's the sort of thing that's dangerous. And Clifford thinks about unjustified beliefs in the same way. Now, often people think, oh, well, you know, I have my funny little irrational beliefs, and they really don't affect anyone. But he thinks that they can. And that even though if the ship doesn't sink, it could have. And so all of your irrational beliefs are a powder keg waiting to explode. And he thinks about these as being sort of like a contagion. And this is why Clifford says, part of why Clifford says, your beliefs aren't your own business. You know, people have this common belief, particularly in America, I have the right to believe whatever I want. How many people would agree with that? Right? Okay. First of all, I'd say, do you have the right to believe 2 and 2 is 5? Can you have a right to believe something that's impossible for you to believe? Okay, well, there's one thing you can't believe. There's one thing you don't have a right to believe because you can't believe it.
You can believe it, but that doesn't mean it's true.
But can you believe something that's logically non-contradictory?
If you like you do.
If you try really
believe it.
If you can twist your logic enough to justify it in your own head.
Can I believe I'm not holding a pen in my hand? Can I really believe that?
You can't believe it doesn't mean you're not allowed to.
But it, okay, if I can't jump to the moon, does it mean that I don't have a right to do it? Or is it like if I could, then I wouldn't be allowed to do it? But you can't. Can you have a right to do something you can't do? Does a person in a wheelchair who's permanently paralyzed have a right to walk? That's not the right to try to walk, a right to walk. Right? It doesn't make it to me. Okay, does a person who has no legs, do they have the right to walk? you know, it seems incoherent to me that you have a right to do something it's impossible for you to do. But okay, let's leave that one on the wayside. Do you have a right to believe anything you want? Do you have a right to believe? Okay, do you have a right to believe it's okay to molest little children?
No.
Believing it is one thing, putting it into practice.
Yeah, but all your actions are stemming from your beliefs. There's a direct correlation between action and beliefs.
Now, we're not talking about political right. We're talking about like a moral right. A right to believe that your race is superior, or that people of other races ought to be treated differently. Or just pick your favorite reprehensible belief. Do you have like a moral right to believe that?
For me, they can believe whatever they want, but once they put that particular belief in practice, that's when I have a problem.
Now, suppose I think that there's a Zionist conspiracy of Jews against the white race, okay, and I make no bones about it, and I say I think Jews are subhuman. They're a spawn of Satan, and they're also, you know, descended from Christ killers, and they're the scourge of the earth. Now imagine you're a Jewish student in my class. Okay? Now, suppose I tell you the first day this is my belief, but then I add, and I'd like you to know that I'm a person of principle, and this will have absolutely no effect on you. Are you really going to, does it seem like that's really going to be the way things shake out?
No.
Probably not, right? You'd think I'd be biased in some way. And Clifford says the same thing is true with your beliefs. If you have a belief, it's not really a belief unless it affects your actions in some way. And it might affect them overtly, or it might affect them covertly in some other way. And now the question is, what effect do your beliefs have effect on other people? And let's take maybe some innocuous things, like talking about your horoscope, for example. And here's what Clifford says. And he has a, let's see, there's that bit about the rustic on the barstool. I really like to find that. We see the bit about the, there's a banging again. Oh, here we go, page 162, that big paragraph at the bottom. For as much as no belief held by one man, however seemingly trivial the belief, and however obscure the believer, is ever actually insignificant or without its effect on the fate of mankind, we have no choice but to extend our judgment to all cases of belief, whatever. Belief, that sacred faculty which prompts the decisions of our will and knits into harmonious working all the compacted energies of our being, is not for ourselves, but for humanity. Okay. And then he says, it is desecrated when given to unproved and unquestioned statements for the souls of the private pleasure of the believer, and to add a tinsel splendor to the straight road of our lives and display a bright mirage beyond it, or even to drown the common sorrows of our kind by a self-deception which allows them not only to be cast down but also to degrade us. Whoso would deserve well of his fellows in this matter will guard the purity of his belief with a very fanaticism of jealous care, lest at any time it should be rest on an unworthy object and cast a stain which can never be wiped away. So, you know, Clifford has a pretty strong view about this, right? Come on, Clifford, tell us what you really think. So he thinks that it's a sin against all mankind when you form an unjustified belief, and particularly when you do it for some private pleasure. Now, what's he thinking about? He's thinking about people that listen to, you know, Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell, and some guy on there last night who's like talking about the metaphysical power of frequencies and vibrations, and he's got this tuning fork that he's hawking on his website, and he's like, you know, knocking it, and this one. And then he's going, oh, you know, chanting with it and channeling the cosmic vibrations. And, you know, think, well, that's kind of nutty. And, you know, it's not sort of my thing, but whatever. But Clifford said, no, evil, wrong. And his idea is that when you have somebody on a radio, you think, well, this is like going out to millions of people, you know, and people are calling in saying, oh yeah, I'm down with the vibrations, dude, and it's totally changed my life. That pretty soon, it's like a disease. It's like not covering your cough. You're spreading it out. You're spreading your ridiculous fantasy, which you think is kind of, ooh, isn't it kind of cool that, you know, there's like vibrations and frequencies? It doesn't really seem rational, but it makes me feel kind of, you know, excited and takes my mind away from my boring job as an accountant, that I can kind of think that there's like this cool cosmic universe, you know, I listen to it on Coast to Coast. So it gives you this sort of pleasure. It kind of tickles your epistemological funny bone, right? To think, ooh, there's like cosmic energies and metaphysical powers and all this cool stuff. And then pretty soon what happens, you end up like, working at the a gold base for the Scientologists as a slave. And pretty soon you're like 30 years old and you have no skills and no savings and you spend half your life as a mind numb robot working for a nefarious organization concerned mostly with making money. Right, so that might be the result. Or it might be that you, in spreading your superstition to someone else, you're kind of into the Scientology stuff, you think it's kind of cool, and you bought Dianetics, and you're like, oh, this is kind of interesting. You took a couple of classes and kind of like lost interest, but you pass a copy of Dianetics on your friend saying, hey, this is great stuff, right? And your friend becomes a Dianetics, Scientologist, a Scientology cultist. And so, Clifford would say, your support not only is like giving your friend the Dianetics book, but even just like talking about your horoscope or talking about the frequencies or talking about conflating, wouldn't it be cool if with, hey, I think it's really true that, or I've always believed that X, therefore X is true. All these irrational patterns of superstitious thinking, belief in occult forces and energies, and just generally shoddy thinking, it spreads to other people. Pretty soon other people are thinking in occult energies, and maybe they get cancer and they decide they're going to go on a macrobiotic diet when it's sort of a localized skin cancer that could have just been cut out by a surgeon's scalpel and a little bit of radiation and chemo, and they'd be good to go. But because they decide to, chant and meditate and, eat Mexican yams or whatever, it ends up spreading into their lymph nodes, and then they're a dead duck. And where does that come from? Well, it comes from this pseudoscientific subculture in America. And to the extent that you add to it in whatever small way, you are in a small way responsible for that person's death, according to culture. Thoughts, disputations, agreements.
What if you had given your friend the Bible and not a...
Controversial.
You're opening
it. I'd say, the question would be whether, people who get Bibles are likely not to get medical treatment. But I suppose also Clifford might say, Clifford is talked about the ship owner having faith, right? And Clifford tends to be kind of down on faith. And I didn't want to get to a big faith and reason thing, which is like, why focus on the kind of pseudoscience ideas, which are a little more practical. But, that's a good question.
Clifford, what do you think he would say?
I think Clifford would say that would be a bad thing for you to do if you said everything in this book is inspired by God and true, because it's an unjustified belief. And maybe there's degrees of like beliefs you can spread to people. If you had said don't go to a doctor, but pray for your teenager's diabetes to go away, that would be a lot more responsible if the person actually did it. Whereas the Bible is more kind of an indirect thing.
Isn't that pushing into the constitutional rights of free speech and stuff, though? If you're saying, well, if anybody has these kind of thoughts, they're just morally wrong. Well, I mean, where's that line?
Yeah, Clifford is kind of a collectivist in his thinking. Now, politically, I'm not sure what Clifford's views were. You can have a collectivist moral view while having a kind of a libertarianist political view. So libertarian political view. So you might think, for example, that everyone has a political right to believe and practice whatever they like as long as they're not directly harming another person. But as far as a person's moral duty, you have a moral duty to only believe in things on sufficient evidence and not to spread baseless rumors and so on. For example, which actually gets to the other example, which is a religious example of the baseless rumor. And here I actually, maybe Clifford's just using this as an example. But notice that Clifford used an example of the persecution of a religious sect and doesn't say anything like, well, these religious people are a bunch of people with irrational superstitions anyway, so they deserve what they get. Right? He says, it would be wrong to spread this vicious rumor about this religious sect. So, maybe, I'm not sure. I mean, that's a really good question about the Bible. I think if Clifford were to be consistent, that would be what he would say, unless there's sufficient evidence to believe the Bible is the word of God, which might be the other side. Did you want to come
in? Yeah, so I had questions. What does he classify as insufficient evidence? Like what is he, like, is there like a scale, like you can
That's a good question.
What's evidence and what's not evidence?
I don't think he really tells you. What he's arguing for is a general principle that, I mean, he's arguing for some pretty radical views. And they're like, you don't have a right to your own belief. Which is like a pretty strong belief. And that you don't have, and that you shouldn't believe anything unless you have sufficient evidence for it. And those are his two beliefs that he's pushing forward. And he doesn't really tell you what sufficient evidence is. So in theory, you could say, well, here, I have sufficient evidence for the Bible in that, and you could sort of bring out archaeology and historical verification and, miracles. I mean, you could try to build a case for the historical reliability of the Bible and then sort of go from there with the internal consistency of the beliefs. And so, I mean, you could try to make that argument. And I think that would be consistent with Clifford's thesis, so, although he might not agree with the application.
So insufficient would be like just based solely on emotions?
No, he would say, sufficient reason is an objective, it's an objective measure. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't tell you what the criteria is for verifying the belief. So he's thinking about rational proofs, which would include things like empirical evidence, logical consistency, for starts, but maybe there might, and then as far as like particular examples, like what counts as sufficient evidence. And this is a general question of in epistemology, how much proof do you need until you've proved something? And that's a big question. But so what is sufficient? Sufficient means enough, so I think so that a reasonable person will give their assent to the proposition. So the reasonable person will believe it. Which seems kind of circular in a way. It's a kind of a normative concept or a concept about what, like the paradigm of the rational person would do. So the idea is that you need a lot and enough to make it rational or justified. But he doesn't give you particulars. So I mean, in a way, you might see that as a problem with his view, but it's actually, I see it as a virtue because this means that he's not locked into any kind of metaphysical paradigm. He's not saying that, and as a consequence of my view, you can't believe in the spiritual world, or you can't believe even in the frequencies or whatever. But he just says if you're going to believe in that, you have to have sufficient evidence.
This seems more like a suggestion rather than like an assertion.
I think he's making the assertion that it's immoral to have an unjustified belief, to have any belief without sufficient evidence. And I see this in the forums, and I think I'm turning there if it's this class or it's another class. I think the online class, someone was talking about, it actually was this class. It was the child prodigy thing. So someone was suggesting that child prodigies were a result of reincarnation. And I said, my response was, that would be great. A great proof of innate ideas if a child prodigy, having never played the piano or never heard any music at all, went up and started playing some Bach, right? But that's not the way it happens. What happens is a child prodigy hears music and then reproduces it, you know, sometimes nearly perfectly. And what, you know, how does this happen? Well, they've done brain images of the person's brain, and it turns out that there's some difference in their brain, the way the cerebellum works with the what's called working memory, which is sort of like RAM in the brain, and you know, there's some difference in their brain. And child prodigies, and you also get a related concept that sort of people are called, I don't know what the PC term is for it now. They used to be called idiot savants, maybe now they're just called savants. But you get these people like the guy in Rain Man who can you know, tell you any day of the week, like you say, you know, October 4th, 2 BC, and he'll say Tuesday. And he'll be able to tell you like what day of the week any date was in all history. And he just sort of knows. But then he can't find his house or, you know, write his name at you. So, but you do get these prodigies. But I think the point in the forum, though, was the idea, well, this person said, some people say it's a result of reincarnation and karma. Other people say there might be some science-y explanation in terms of, like, you know, psychology or brain stuff, you know. And I guess it's just anybody's opinion. And, you know, Clifford would be, you know, tearing his garment in half and throwing sackcloth and ashes on his head if he heard that. Because he'd be thinking a scientific explanation based on empirical evidence versus some fanciful theory about reincarnation, and it's just anybody's opinion. Obviously, one theory has the benefit of having a lot of empirical evidence, scientific evidence. The other theory is a baseless speculation based on what's in some old books and some subjective experiences that people have when they you know, meditate. And he'd say, you know, obviously, the one is preferable to the other. And the idea that every opinion is equal to every other opinion is also another common, you know, typically American belief, and one that Clifford thinks is just, you know, is ruinous. It's kind of relativism. Because there are some opinions which are justified by sufficient evidence. There are other opinions which are absolutely baseless. And to give an example, another example, the baseless rumor. So dangerous, wrong in itself, dangerous, this is, I'll just put a sin against reason in man's conscience. And, you know, and maybe even our ancestors, you know, who struggled. From the nut, you know, to create science and civilization.
It's kind of ironic to use the word sin.
Yeah, well, it's a stain that can never be wiped away, right? It's just this idea that, you know, I think about like some guy who read his horoscope and shared it with a friend, and then later on he's like Jimmy Spider with the tears rolling down his cheeks saying, I have sinned. And this is the way Clifford thinks about it, that when you believe some superstitious nonsense, you're spitting in the face of every scientist and philosopher and engineer who ever lived. Right? You're like, you get people that they spread nonsense about, like, you know, Q-ray bracelets that give quantum healing. You see, people like they buy their Q-ray bracelet, or they you know, put magnets in their bed or something, and then like there's people that like labor their whole lives to understand the nature of reality and quantum physics. And then you get some huckster who's selling something using the word quantum, you know, and then combine it with like some mystical theory about healing, you know, sort of supernatural healing. And so he's like, he sells these Q-ray bracelets that deliver quantum healing. And he's just using scientific jargon based on the work of these people that, like, you know, work their asses off to try to understand the way the world works and try to better further human knowledge and mankind. Meanwhile, you don't know a damn thing about quantum physics, but yeah, the Q-ray bracelet might help your arthritis or something. And so you buy like a schmuck. And he thinks that's just, you know, you're not only are you an idiot, and not only are you wasting your money, but you're doing something which is, that's a sin against the history of science and knowledge. And you're a bad person for doing that. So his other example is the baseless rumor. And, you know, the similar sort of, so what's the idea of the baseless rumor? What's the scandalous rumor about this religious sect in a small island community? So, you know, rumors spread really fast. There's not a lot of people. And so you get this particular sect, and there's bad news. People hear something about it, and they sort of spread it to their neighbors. So what's the rumor? They don't believe in certain things that you should believe in. And they're like, one is the eternal damnation of the unsaved. And what's the other one? Is it Satan?
Yeah.
So they don't believe in Satan and hell, basically. Which, you know, at the time, if it was right, and those people are considered to be heretics. I mean, they're still heretics today, but as, you know, Christianity has become a lot more liberal, you get these mainline denominations, and you take surveys of the Methodists and the Episcopalians and the Lutherans, and they don't believe in Satan and hell and demons either. But at the time, the majority of people believe in Satan and hell. So they're teaching there's no hell and there's no Satan. And he says, if you spread this rumor without checking out to see whether it's true, that's wrong. And it would be wrong even if the rumor was true. And again, why is that?
Because it's unfounded.
Yeah, you were just lucky. You just got lucky. You're like the drunk driver who got lucky that he didn't kill anybody. You're lucky that the rumor was true. Because often, if it's a baseless rumor, right? Often the baseless rumors, which don't have sufficient evidence, they turn out to be false. And you can harm a person's reputation, right? There was another rumor about the sect is that they were indoctrinating the island's children into their heretical beliefs. So not only did they believe the wrong things about religion, but they were trying to convince others, they're trying to corrupt the children of the island, right? So how would people respond to this belief if they thought it was true? Burn down their church, right? They might do all sorts of, assault members, persecute them, try to drive them off the island, right? And they might be doing this for something that turned out not to be true, because they didn't check it out. I suppose you might say that it would be wrong for them to drive them off the island or burn down their church even if it did turn out to be true. Although you'd think there might be some consequence if you're trying to interfere with their religious upbringing of somebody else's children. That seems to be a violation of their parental rights. Anyhow, those are similar to the ship owner pushing Clifford's idea that it's wrong to believe anything on insufficient evidence. So what do you think about harmless superstitions? Are they really harmless? Is there such a thing as a harmless superstition?
Yeah.
You think so? Like what?
You could believe that stepping on a crack breaks a woman's back. It doesn't really hurt anybody if you make
that. But how about you say you're walking on the sidewalk with your friend and you're like, your friend's looking at you like how come you're not, or they might see you like skip over a crack and like, what was that about? And you're like, oh, stepping on cracks, bad luck.
It's still not harming the other person.
Well, what the other person's like, you know, they're walking along and they're thinking, maybe I shouldn't step on any cracks.
It still doesn't harm them.
Is there a way that could snowball this idea? You shouldn't step on cracks in the sidewalk or it will cause some harm.
Yeah,
Yeah.
It's all about wasting time and energy to figure out the cracks.
What if, unknown to you, your friend has obsessive compulsive disorder and it's just gotten better, but now that he's left, he sees you like jumping over the crack, he's like, I need to avoid the cracks in the sidewalk, and pretty soon he's back to washing his hands 100 times a day. It's all your fault. Okay, probably not likely, but that what Clifford would say, that if you have that belief, is that likely to be just one belief which exists in isolation to all your other beliefs? If you have that belief, that represents a general pattern or principle of superstitious thinking. And so you probably read your horoscope, you're probably not walking your ladders, you're probably throwing salt over your shoulder, you're engaging in all these sort of superstitious rituals that, again, Clifford would say they're kind of like a contagion. They spread to other people. People see you, you'll knock on wood, right? Like, you know, people will do this, they'll say, yeah, I haven't been sick in 3 years. Well, knock on wood, right? A few people do that, and you think, well, that's just sort of an innocuous thing. But you think about that sort of general weird psychological thing that people do, this kind of whistling to the graveyard idea is a kind of a pattern of superstitious thinking where people engage in meaningless rituals thinking that it imputes some metaphysical or cosmic power to protect them from harm. Like my mom has this thing where she recites the Lord's Prayer before she goes on a long drive. She's not a Christian, she doesn't particularly believe in Jesus, he's one of the ascended masters, but she imputes some magical power into this. Meanwhile, she'll like ignore like the seatbelt sign on short drive going bing, 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 right? Why? Because she thinks that she's sort of like under the protection of her guardian angel. And so it's part of a general irrational belief which might cause her harm in the long run. Maybe if she had, instead of reciting the Lord's Prayer, if she'd made sure that, taking her car for a safety inspection or done something else, if she didn't believe she had this extra protection, maybe she'd be a little more careful about making sure her car was in proper repair or that her seatbelt was properly anchored or what have you. Yeah.
I was going to say, on the other hand, those little beliefs might put people at ease. I mean, that's beneficial. Lessen stress or anxiety just by doing these little things. And, I read my horoscope sometimes. I don't believe it. I suppose it's interesting. I even have a Capricorn tattooed on my ankle, but I don't believe in that.
Uh-huh.
It's just interesting.
I had a friend, people used to ask him, back in the 70s, early 80s, people would come and say, what's your sign? And he would say, the sign of the blood-stained cross. Because he thought the astrology was bad. He's a committed Christian and saw astrology as being occultic. But yeah, Clifford, I think, would say there's nothing wrong with Clifford might say even if you read your horoscope and make light of it, that's probably a good thing. But if you read it, as long as you don't take it seriously, or spread it to other people. Like if you tell someone, I'm a Gemini, without further commentary, that makes the person think that you really believe in this astrology stuff. And so that, and Clifford would say that would be bad. Now, Clifford might say, like your Capricorn tattoo, that might, sort of make people put credence in astrology who otherwise might not. So he might... He might think that you should cover up that tattoo.
By your pants, you'll never know.
That's true. I think people also have this idea, though, that I have a right to believe any silly, stupid, superstitious thing I want. Or people have the idea that life's kind of boring and humdrum if you don't have some kind of kooky beliefs that they kind of make the world more colorful. And then maybe reason really isn't a good guide to life. Maybe you should go on feelings or rely on the guidance of the spirits or what have you. I keep on making these woo-woo gestures. So what do you think about that? Is Clifford a fanatic in the other direction? Do your beliefs have this kind of effect on people? Or I think you make a good point about to be made about this anxiety being alleviated. Rituals, whether religious or whether what we might call superstitions, they reduce anxiety. You don't feel, people wear their lucky golf shirt, right? And then they do a really good golf game and they impute it to their lucky golf shirt. And where do they go golf? And they wear that shirt. Well, maybe they actually might golf better because they believe they're going to golf better, the placebo effect. So maybe there's actually, and if you look at, for example, if you assume that Clifford would say that religious people are less rational because they believe in things that can't be proven, because they believe in things on the basis of faith. If you look demographically, religious people do better than people who aren't religious. And you just go down the line, better relationships, make more money, report being happier, less stress, less substance abuse problems. You just go down the line that religious people end up having better lives than non-religious people statistically. And so you might say, well, maybe a little superstition is like a little wine. It's good for you as long as it's not done to excess.
I don't know if Clifford would agree with this, but basically the worst thing you can do is think that your beliefs don't affect others, because then you basically, I mean, for you to like look at your horoscope and like think, yeah, that's kind of funny or quirky, but to then make the statement like, well, my horoscope said this and it came true, and you think it's still quirky and funny, but somebody else takes it seriously, then the implications are, there's like a direct correlation between what you say and how it affects another person.
Mm-hmm.
For positive or negative, you don't know. But if you fail to see that it does do something, then you could be going around spreading stuff that's really dangerous.
Yeah, you never know what the consequences will be of your actions or what somebody... Now, I suppose that the other line might be that, well, you're not responsible for what other people do or what other people believe. That's up to them. So, like, for example... guy that shot Congresswoman Gabby Giffords. So the argument is made that it was violent political rhetoric from the Tea Party and from Sarah Palin that set this guy off. Now, there's no evidence that this had any effect. So there was a mailer. There was a mailer. This guy didn't. He wasn't a Tea Party guy. His friend said that he was a left-wing pot smoker. Not that there's anything wrong with smoking pot, but this guy was a left-wing pot smoker, which tends not to fit into the Tea Party demographic, right? He was railed against Bush. His issues were the misuse of grammar. And he had, I suppose, the one belief that he had, which might be sort of a conservative-ish view, is about the debasing of the currency, which turns out to be, it's a true belief about the government debasing of currency. So, but that was one, that if you had to pick like one belief this guy had that was conservative, and he sort of didn't like the government in some respects. But this guy wasn't like a conservative. He was all over the map politically, and his friends said that he would rail against Bush and his left wing. But the thought was that a political climate of angry rhetoric might have set him off and might have drove him to violence. Now, it turns out that wasn't the case. The guy didn't even watch cable news. He didn't have a TV. He didn't listen to talk radio. So he wouldn't have picked up any of this stuff. Chances are. He didn't read the newspaper. But the argument is that he could have. Right, so Sarah Palin sends out a mailer that says, we're targeting Gabby Giffords' district, send us money. And it's got like a bullseye over, the district, right? Now, it doesn't have a bullseye over the congresswoman. It's just got a bullseye over her face. Is that something to worry about? I'd say anybody who would think that, look at this mailer, and the language of targeting is targeting districts. It's used all the time in politics. should I avoid saying things like, you know, we're targeting so and so for you know, for being unseated in the next election, because somebody might get the crazy idea that I'm using the word targeting and therefore that they should shoot that person. I mean, that's an irrational based on what I said. So that person's responsible for their beliefs and I'm responsible for mine. And if my belief might sort of in some small way, like so if someone takes something I say and they draw the wrong conclusion, is that really my fault? That's supposed to be the question to ask. See, it seems like it's not. Now what if it's then the question is, what if I do something which is like sort of I express an unjustified belief and someone else draws an even more radical unjustified belief, which turns out to be harmful. So I express my unharmful belief and that another person is affected in that they form a harmful belief based on what I said and maybe some other input. Do I bear any responsibility there? Yeah.
You just expressed your belief. You didn't like push it on them, right? Or want them or force them to really believe it. So it's not your fault that they turned out to go all radical and nuts like that.
Yeah, I just sneezed in the elevator. It's not my fault that other people breathed in the particulates of my disease. That's what Clifford would say.
You didn't cover your face.
Well, that would be analogous to like not expressing my belief. But if I spread my belief in public, now if I keep it to myself, that might be one thing. And I suppose if people see me acting on my belief, or they see me, or I tell them about my belief, it seems like I bear some responsibility if they adopt my belief. I don't have to actually necessarily try to convince them of it. I'm like, oh yeah, my horoscope said that I should avoid elevators, so I'm taking stairs today. Right? If I like say that enough people think, oh, I wonder what my horoscope says. And pretty soon they're like a slave to their horoscope, and maybe they don't attend their daughter's wedding later on because their astrologer told them it would be bad mojo, that they shouldn't go to Alabama that weekend because their son was in the house of Venus or whatever, right? They end up like, you know, and again, it starts out sort of small where they start reading the horoscope. Pretty soon they're actually paying somebody money to have like a detailed horoscope drawn up for them personally. Things start out small most of the time. People don't just all of a sudden start spending a bunch of money on astrologers and obsessing about what the stars say about what they should do. These things start out small and they tend to snowball. Yeah.
Well, wouldn't Clifford think that any of that was bad? Or even, I was thinking back even with the Sarah Palin, the response. She actually got on TV and responded to it, which I thought made it even worse, rather than just ignoring it. If she would have just ignored it, then it was just, you know, targeting of the area. But she got on and, wouldn't Clifford think that that was just as bad?
Yeah, I don't know. She used this word blood libel, which is
right.
But I mean, which is a perfectly good word, and in general, also in general discourse about this idea that whenever something went wrong, like the well went bad or something like that, people would think some Jew must have poisoned the well, and they'd go, you know, burn down their houses or kill them or what have you. And this is like, it's sort of like scapegoat, right? Scapegoat doesn't really have much to do with scapegoats from the Old Testament or from the Yom Kippur ritual. But it's just sort of like a general term. But yeah, I think there's this question about if people put false accusations against you over and over again, people are going to believe that, so you might even have an obligation to counteract it.
Witch hunts would be an example.
Yeah, that's a good example. Sure, that's a great example, witch hunts. If you're, and you can have like, you know, witch hunts, you know, modern witch hunts is actually used. Although, interestingly, like people that practice modern-day Wicca don't like the idea of witch hunt either. Is that they feel the same way that some Jews feel about blood libel, the use of witch hunt. But the literal witch hunt, sure, that's a good example of unjustified beliefs. And the Salem witch trials, you had people, I'm trying to remember how many, I think 70 or 80 people ended up being hanged, something like that. So this is in Salem, Massachusetts, on the late 17th century, I think. And then, you know, a few years later, there was like apologies the government issued an apology for what they did, but it was hysteria. So, and I listened to this really interesting show the other night, and actually, I'll post this on the forum. There's a guy who I think it shows how like unjustified beliefs work. There's this guy Paul Haggis. He's a famous writer director, and he's written screenplays for all kinds of big Hollywood movies. Directed a lot of them. I'm trying to think of the famous ones he's done. Now I'm blanking out on. But he's done a lot of famous movies you've heard about. I'll post his IMDb profile too. So Paul Haggis ends up becoming a Scientologist. And he ends up, at the end of it, it wasn't like all the crazy stuff about Xenu and the extraterrestrials and all the crazy stuff that finally got to him. It was Proposition 8. Because he's got a couple of lesbian daughters, and that was the straw that broke the camel's back for him was that some local Scientology center in San Diego put their name on the list of supporters for Prop 8, and he wanted the large organization to denounce them. And it turns out that L. Ron Hubbard himself considered homosexuality a perversion, and. But the annual Hollywood is all about the gay rights, and so anyway, this was the thing that broke it for him. But you know, this guy, the Scientology. He thought that some of the good aspects actually, he said, helped him in his relationships in some ways, helped him to become more successful. There's a question about how successful he would have been without Scientology. Maybe he would have done just as well. A lot of his connections. Were in Scientology too, and then he was locked into a place where he has all his friends are Scientologists, all his Hollywood connections are Scientologists. So the question is, if he drops out, early in his career, whether his career would end up taking a nosedive, because all of a sudden all his partners and all his people he knows in the industry are going to consider him persona non grata if he leaves the church. He ended up being out probably at least $600,000. He said he probably spent probably $300,000 in courses and at least another $300,000 in donations. But he's not sure how much money. It's just a guess. That's like a lot of money, right? the other story I heard was on Coast to Coast AM. Actually, they threw in a few legitimate guests just to keep you guessing. They had this guy who wrote a book about leaving Scientology, and this guy entered this group called Sea Org, this sort of base out in the desert, and started working at them for them when he was like, I think, 15, and I didn't get out till he was around 30, and he was like paid, his whole time there, in 15 years, he made a total of $28,000. Period. So he's getting and he's working 100-hour weeks, basically treated as a slave. And So it's this crazy. And this shows the extreme. So if you start thinking sort of non-rational ways, in terms of authority, in terms of I'm no good, I can't make my decisions. Here's a person who seems to understand what's going on, and I'm sort of going to put myself in a subordinate position to them and stop, critically analyzing what people say. I'm just going to take it on faith. If you live your life in that way, then you could end up as a member of a cult, or you could end up dying of a preventable disease. Or you could end up, just making some horrible financial decision that results in losing your life savings. Or you could fall prey to some sort of scam that might hurt you in some way. You might lose all of your assets. So there are numerous ways in which making decisions on insufficient evidence and being moved by emotion rather than rationality can cause bad consequences. And so Clifford again would say that not only is it in your interest to form your decisions rationally and logically, but it's your moral duty. That's about all we have time for today, so we're going to pick up with William James on the will to believe, who has a different view than Clifford's on Wednesday.